Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. The University Press of Florida has just released 2 memoirs by celebrated dancers who describe what it was like to work with 2 of the greatest choreographers of the 20th century. Dancing with Merce Cunningham is by Marianne Prager-Simon, who was a member of the Merce Cunningham Dance Company during its founding years from 1950 to 1958, and Broadway, Balanchine and Beyond was co-written by Betty Jane Sills, Elizabeth McPherson. Miss Sills danced with New York City Ballet from 1961 to 1972. And I'm very pleased to welcome all of these people to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Pleasure to be here.
And this one I'm throwing out to both of you, Marianne and Betty Jane. Is it true that neither of you started out planning to become dancers? What about you, Marianne? Marianne, can you hear me? Ooh. Okay, well, let's start with you, Betty Jane. You come out of a show business family, but
I
was
do.
Dance part of what you wanted to do from the start?
Consciously, I don't think that I specifically felt I wanted to dance. My parents, especially my mother, put me on the stage in show business at a very young age, the age of 7.
She was a showbiz mom.
She was a stage mom. My dad was in show business and sang and was a musician as well. And I loved to dance. I loved to dance around the living room, as they say.
But you appeared in musicals on Broadway.
Yes, I did.
You were in... both 17 and also Seventh Heaven?
Correct, but I didn't dance in either of those shows. 17, I had a featured speaking role as Jane Baxter, the sister, and Seventh Heaven was a smaller role, but neither of those roles was a dancing role.
And then you were also doing TV?
Yes.
Studio One, Children's Hour. Did you think you were going to be a dancer, or I mean, an actor, or was dancing always at the back of your mind?
Dancing was always a big part of my training and my life, but I think when I went to the School of American Ballet, that was really what set me on the road to really think about becoming a ballet dancer.
Did you have classes with Balanchine?
Not when I was a child, no. But when I joined New York City Ballet, yes.
So you were doing that, and then you were also at the High School of Performing Arts at one point, doing both acting and dancing?
Well, I auditioned for both departments, and I had to make a choice. So I chose the dance department, and that's where my focus sort of ended up.
And Elizabeth... your name, you give equal billing on the cover of Betty Jane's book, Broadway, Balanchine and Beyond. You're an associate professor of the Department of Theater and Dance at Montclair State University. How did you come to collaborate with Betty Jane on this?
I believe it was in 2013. I was asked to teach in the MFA program at Purchase College. And Betty Jane has been on faculty there for many, many years, and that's where we met. I actually was teaching something called choreology, which was a 4-semester dance history, dance criticism sequence. And I had the students do oral interviews with somebody in the dance field that they were particularly inspired by and wanted to learn more information about. And one of my students decided to interview Betty Jane. And in doing that, I think it began to bring Betty Jane back to wanting to do this project. It's something that she had worked on several years before, had begun writing some, and then had kind of abandoned it. And then this sort of brought it all back up, and the student, Allison, put us together, kind of, and then we started working from there.
So this is kind of an as told to?
Betty Jane had done some writing herself, and I used extant writing. I also did interviews with her. She filled in gaps. She kept writing and writing, and I was putting pieces together. I personally am fascinated by personal voice. My last book was an edited volume about the Bennington School of the Dance, and that was a bunch of, I did a lot of interviews for that, and so it was really fun to help her story come to life.
Let's bring Marianne Prager-Simon into this conversation. Marianne, didn't you first meet Merce Cunningham in 1949 while you were studying in Paris during your junior year of college?
That is correct, yes.
Now, many Americans were going there during the post-World War II years. What was the attraction at that time?
Well, the post-war was years in France, first of all, and then here, too, were just like people were breaking out in creative juices because they'd been so confined during the war years. And now is a chance for everything to bloom. And artists and musicians and theater people and dancers and everybody was just overflowing with creative energy. It was a wonderful time.
Two of the illustrations in your book are drawings, one of you by Ellsworth Kelly, and
right.
Then there's your drawing of him.
That's
so,
right.
That was pretty heavy company, although he wasn't famous at the time. He was on the verge.
He was very young. He was just graduated from school.
Were you considering becoming an artist?
I wasn't considering anything except whatever came up along the road, I grabbed it.
So did I get the feeling that you saw Merce dance that spring and that changed your goals?
Well, I thought that was so exciting that I would go back and I wanted to continue studying drama, which is what I had turned into from the Sorbonne when I was in France. First, I was going to go take my junior year abroad. Then I thought, well, this is so much more interesting. So I went to a drama school of Jean-Louis Barrault. And then when I came back to New York, I decided to continue going to drama school, but I wanted to take classes with Merce.
And you were his first student after you returned to New York.
Yes, I was the only student for the first couple of classes.
So he was not well known yet, but he was about 30 when you met him?
That's right.
Did he was he already forming his own company?
Not yet. He had danced with Martha Graham for a number of years and was known through her as a beautiful dancer, particularly his aerial skills were amazing, his leaping and jumping. He was a beautiful dancer. And over the period of time that I was in his class, and then a few more people came in, like Remy Charlip and Carolyn Brown and Viola Farber, he decided that what he wanted was dancers who he had trained in his style so that we wouldn't have the mannerisms of other styles. And so that we became a company officially in 1953.
Now, Betty Jane, did Balanchine also dance?
Oh, yes. He danced.
So did he demonstrate while he was
teaching? He did demonstrate. He demonstrated, and he also indicated with his hands what he wanted. But quite often he would demonstrate.
Although
yes.
At this point he was quite elderly. Well, he was older.
He was older, I think. I'm not sure exactly how old he was when I joined the company, but he was quite agile. He really was.
Marianne, Jay Kaplan says Merce Cunningham was perhaps the most important and innovative figure in dance in the second half of the 20th century.
Yes.
Now, first of all, we're talking about modern dance because...
Yes, that's right.
Because we're also talking with a Balanchine dancer, and he was pretty important. But do you think he was more important than Martha Graham, Alvin Ailey, Paul Taylor, or some of the other greats?
Well, Paul Taylor was in his company. It was the first place he danced, was in Merce's company. But what Merce did was he broke the narrative bands that everybody was confined to. And his choreography didn't have a story at all, which was very confusing for American audiences at first.
And critics as well.
And critics as well. Yes, they thought it was, you know, nonsense.
What about the dancers? Because dancers are often trained to work, well, with the story, but also to the beat of the music. And he was defying that as well.
Yeah, and that was why he wanted to train his own dancers, so that we wouldn't be wedded to things that we had been doing before. So we were all very young and had not had a lot of experience with I had no experience with other choreographers. I don't think Carolyn did either. She had been in college and just starting out. Although she was trained by her mother, who was a dancer. But Merce really wanted us to start with what he was doing, and so he wanted not to use any more Graham dancers, not to use dancers from other companies, but to have his own company that would really feel comfortable doing what he did.
When you say Carolyn, you're talking about Carolyn Brown, another wonderful dancer.
She was wonderful.
Betty Jane, the same question for you. George Balanchine is often declared the greatest American ballet choreographer of the 20th century. Did he have any rivals, or were all of his rivals in Russia? After all, Nijinsky was a pretty great choreographer.
I don't think he had any rivals because his idea and Lincoln Kirstein's idea when he brought Balanchine to the United States was to develop an American ballet company with an American school. So that innovative idea was not really in competition with anything in Russia.
Or France. So does that mean actually inventing a new style? Because
somewhat.
To some degree, ballet looks like ballet.
Yeah, I mean, Balanchine's origins were Russian. He was Russian trained. But he also didn't want to have his ballets be purely story ballets. They were like Merce in a way, movement to music. And I might want to mention to Marianne and to you as well that Merce came to New York City Ballet and set one of his pieces on us. And
yes.
I got to understudy. It was Summer Space, Marianne.
Oh.
Yes, he set it on point.
Oh.
And I was an understudy. Unfortunately, I never got to perform it, but I remember working with him in the studio.
And we're seeing a lot more of that cross-fertilization. Is this something that happens more in America? Like, we have people like Twyla Tharp choreographing ballet as well. Paul Taylor did is also.
Yep.
This is something that's fairly new to dance, isn't it?
I'm not sure.
I would think so.
I'm speaking about dance with Marianne Prager-Simon, whose book is Dancing with Merce Cunningham, and with Betty Jane Sills, whose book, written with Elizabeth McPherson, is Broadway, Balanchine, and Beyond. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM in New York. Now, in your case, Marianne, you hadn't danced when you were a kid, so what were some of the biggest challenges you faced as someone who didn't grow up dancing from an early age? Were they both physical and mental?
Both, yes. I often feel that I was very lucky to be there right at the beginning so that I, you know, evolved into his company because my feet didn't point as well as other people's, and you know, my extension was not as high and all those kinds of things, but I had a a great spirit, which he appreciated, and I had very strong legs, so that helped.
But did you first begin dancing after you had an Achilles tendon injury? No, I've
yes.
I've had one. I'm still limping a bit.
Well, I guess this wasn't very serious.
Uh-huh.
But what the funny thing was that the doctor who was, you know, putting my foot in this boiling water said, "Oh, you have such flexible feet. You should be a dancer. You should go take the dance company, dance class." So I said, "Okay." So I went and joined the dance class at Cornell, and everything. You know, one thing just sort of led to another. I was not a great planner. I just followed serendipity.
Betty Jane, how old were you when, in 1961, when Balanchine invited you to join the New York City Ballet?
I was 19.
And you began a member, as everybody does, as of the Court de Ballet, promoted to soloist in 1963. So you were just 21 at the time.
64, yes.
And then you started dancing principal works almost from the start.
Well, actually, I was given solo roles even when I was in the Corps, because Balanchine had a habit of taking dancers who he liked and allowing them to dance soloist roles and principal roles. But yes, I danced solo roles when I was made a soloist and some principal roles.
And you say in your book that people were often surprised by who he decided to give those solos to. It was only after they developed that you realized, well, maybe he saw something that we didn't.
Yes, he had impeccable taste, and generally, most of the time, he was right about his casting choices.
You say your biggest problem was weight.
Not
you're a thin person.
I am, and I was never fat. By normal people's standards. I used to be able to eat anything I wanted when I was a child because I was extremely thin and I hardly ate anything. And then when I joined the company and we were on tour in Europe and I was eating all these, you know, whipped cream and all these fancy desserts.
Right? Marianne's laughing.
I know.
Remember, she met Merce in Paris, not exactly a bad place to eat.
Right. And then I was asked by Diana Adams, who was Mr. Balanchine's kind of spokesperson at the time in the company, well, Mr. B thinks you really should watch your weight. You know, it was not a big deal. And I started to diet, and I dieted sensibly. I didn't starve myself, and about 9 pounds came off, and I did it slowly, and I was rewarded. I was given a role, in a principal role in Divertimento number 15 by Mozart, and the problems kind of evolved over the years that I was there, that I would be thin for a good long time, and then I would gain the weight back. And then I would, Mr. B might take me out of something occasionally, but then I would still have nice things to dance. So I would lose the weight again, I would gain it back, and this went on, unfortunately, for a while.
Marianne, that's not an issue when you're doing modern dance?
Well, it was not an issue for any of us in the company. I don't know whether that's an issue for people, but I've never heard anybody speak about it. It sounds very painful.
Merce never said to anybody in the company, "You got to lose a few pounds."
No, I never heard him do that. He once implied to Remy Charlip, by way of other people, so that he didn't have to tell him, that he should wear a toupee because he was bald in the front.
Betty Jane, during your 12 years with the New York City Ballet, you danced as the wife in Jerome Robbins' revival of the concert. Was working with Robbins very different than working with Balanchine?
Very different. Mr. Balanchine knew exactly what he wanted when he came into rehearsal. He had prepared at home, obviously, and he worked very quickly. We didn't do a lot of standing around. With Jerry, it was different. He had major insecurities about his his work. And so he was never sure exactly what he wanted. And so we would be trying new steps, and then he would change it, and then he would go back to the old way. And so we sometimes never knew what version we were doing.
And yet he was a great choreographer.
Great choreographer.
But was it very different? Was what he was looking for, the aesthetic, very different than Balanchine's?
I'd say yes. Jerry Robbins wanted us to feel a certain motivation, I think, about the work we were doing. I mean, why were we doing something? And certainly when I was doing an acting role, like the wife in the concert, I was literally coached by him. Timing, we would work on the timing of a gesture or a facial expression. And with Balanchine, it was not that way. It was really mostly pure movement to the music. The musicality was very important.
Marianne, did you work for any other choreographers?
Very briefly, I danced with a woman named Iris Mabry, but that was very short-lived. And Judith Martin, who did sort of playwriting dancing, and I did that a little. But mostly I was with Merce. That was my main everything. I was totally devoted.
And you write, many of us dancers were somewhat in love with him.
Yeah.
About Merce. Weren't you aware that he was gay?
No, that never even occurred to me. It never occurred to anybody.
Even though John Cage was there?
That's right.
His romantic partner?
That's right. It was, you know, they kind of kept it underground a little bit. It was before the, the coming out of gay people. And so we didn't realize it for a long time.
Now, I imagine working in such a close-knit company, there's an awful lot of that sort of thing happening. Was that happening with the Cunningham group, or was just everybody in love with Merce?
I think pretty much everybody was in love with Merce. That's a good way to put it.
Betty Jane.
We were good friends with each other.
On the other hand, Betty Jane, didn't Balanchine have affairs with a number of his dancers and even marry three of them?
Yes, he did.
When I asked Maria Tallchief, who was his second wife, about the fact that he had left her for another woman, and yet she was saying all these positive things about him, she said, yes, but he was a genius.
Right. I think that all of his wives still adored him, even when he left them for another woman. And it's true.
You also write about jealousy among company members. Is this jealousy about roles, or were there also romantic competition?
Not so much romantic competition for Balanchine's attention, but there was competition and for his attention in terms of roles. You know, what roles that they could get from him.
Well, you work with a much bigger company than Marianne was. Marianne, when you started, how many people were there in the original Merce Cunningham company?
Oh, I think there were six of us. And then there was one or two extra people who would sometimes step in when necessary. But it was very small.
Enough to fit into a VW microbus, which we'll talk about that a little later.
But okay.
I want to ask Betty Jane about going on a tour of the Soviet Union during the Cold War and then also and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Did love of ballet rise above politics?
Well, I think the Balanchine was, when he came back, this was the first time that he had been back to Russia. And when we went with the company in 1962, and the audiences adored us. I mean, they would line the streets when we came out of the theater to get on the bus to take us back to the hotel. They would line the streets and applaud.
I can't remember if it was Jacques d'Amboise or another one of his male dancers who the Russian audiences fell in love with, and it really upset Mr. B because he didn't want him to have big roles.
I think it was Edward Villella.
Yeah, Edward Villella.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He talked about the complications of working with Balanchine. But he was forced because the audiences were so thrilled by Villella that to keep him in those roles.
I think Balanchine was trying to keep away from the star aesthetic. I think that's what it probably wasn't so much not giving him roles. It was that he wanted the company to be cohesive.
Well, the Soviet Union had the Bolshoi, one of the world's greatest ballet companies. How did the two companies compare in styles?
I felt that the Bolshoi was had a much more emotional, flamboyant way of moving than the American dancers.
And it definitely did want to produce stars.
It definitely wanted to, yes. But, you know, you're always going to have stars. Even when Balanchine took away the billing, you know, because he felt that the dancers were being divas, he wanted everybody to be equal. It couldn't be. You know, there were always going to be stars.
Because some people are just better dancers than others, or connect to the audience better?
I'd say all of that. Maybe not necessarily better dancers, but I think it's connected to his ability to give dancers what they did best, and that would, you know, would feed off this each other, that kind of idea.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM, talking with two of the finest dancers of the 20th century who worked with two of the greatest choreographers. And my guests on Leonard Lopate at Large today are Marianne Prager-Simon, whose book, Dancing with Merce Cunningham, talks about her life before and after Cunningham. She danced with the original Merce Cunningham Dance Company during its founding years from 1950 to 58, and with Betty Jane Sills, who has co-written a memoir with Elizabeth McPherson called Broadway, Balanchine, and Beyond, and that tells the story of her show business career and what happened afterward. Marianne, you were about to tell us about that Volkswagen microbus, but first, you write that the early years of the Cunningham for Cunningham were kind of lean, and that your well-off father would treat the two of you to fine dinners, and that was a way you got by?
Yeah, that's right. Because he was so ignored by the critics and therefore by the public, he really didn't have a lot of opportunity to perform, and certainly didn't earn much money at all.
So what were you doing to survive?
Well, we all had jobs. I had a part-time teaching job at the New Lincoln School in New York City. I taught dance, drama, and world literature. So, you know, that helped, and my father helped. And I think everybody else was involved in some kind of other work or being supported by somebody.
You tell some rather amusing stories, like the troops budget outings in a VW microbus during the early days, including a 22-hour bus trip to Asheville, North Carolina in 1953. What happened?
Yeah, that was when they considered the formation of the Merce Cunningham Company was at Black Mountain in 1953. Mm-hmm. And it was an extreme... He pulled us from various places, because some people were out in the South and some in the West, and then some of us were from New York with him, and so I took the bus myself to go to Black Mountain, North Carolina, and it was an extremely long trip, and
it was a legendary school for the arts.
Yes, but it was very, very progressive and very innovative. And it only lasted, I think, about 8 or 10 years because nobody answered the phone in the office. And, you know, they just weren't quite up to mastering what you do when you want something to last. So, yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, so on the trip down to North Carolina, I got so tired of sitting in the on the seat of a bus that I tried on one of the bus rides to turn around and sit backwards with my stomach in the back of the seat and found out that that didn't work.
You also write about eating mushrooms that John Cage had foraged by the side of the road while you were touring across the country in that bus. Now, John Cage is famous for his expertise in mushrooms. That's was another side of him.
Yeah.
Didn't even write a book about it?
I'm not sure. I don't know about that. But he was very dedicated to... We would be riding along in the microbus, and he would say, "Hey, stop! I see mushrooms! I see mushrooms!" And so we would stop, and he would pick them, and then we'd eat them at the next stop for lunch or dinner. And my mother said, "I don't mind your dancing with those crazy people, but don't eat those mushrooms." And then it turned out that at some point, he made a dinner of mushrooms for his friends, and they all got sick.
So he didn't always know which ones were poisonous.
No, he was trying to balance his interest in Zen, which meant that, you know, all things are equal, with having discriminating among the mushrooms. So those two things were somewhat in conflict, because he had to discriminate with mushrooms, but he had to not discriminate as a Zen person.
How long was John Cage a part of this group?
Oh, until he died. And he was always with us.
Oh, really?
And he was the musician. He and David Tudor would play the piano together. And
That's when he played the piano, because he did write a composition where you sit at the piano.
Yes.
And then you don't play.
That's right.
How long? 4.5 minutes or something?
2 minutes and 33 seconds. Yes, that was one of his. And the point of that for him was that ambient sounds were as important as the piano. And the audience did not quite agree with him.
Well, he wouldn't talk about the meaning of his works with the dancers, so... Did the dancers discuss their own ideas about what the works meant?
Well, we tended to make up stories because we were used to that, you know, from our lives and from earlier kinds of dances. Right. So we made up our own stories, and sometimes we'd share them with him, and he would smile.
Because he was doing non-narrative choreography.
That's right. Definitely non-narrative and not attached to the music at all.
Didn't he also employ chants? Can't that be confusing for the dancers?
It wasn't confusing for us, because he had, when he choreographed by chants, then he would bring the finished work to us and teach us the parts. But it was a very interesting thing, because chance and improvisation are really different, because improvisation comes from your imagination, which means it's always limited by what you can think of. Whereas chance, for instance, he'd throw dice or use the I Ching, and he'd have different parts of the body listed, like the right hand goes up, or the left leg goes down, or something, you know, whatever it was. And then he'd throw dice and put them together. So if the right hand was going up and the left foot was going down, that's what you would do. And he'd have to work it out so that it was smooth. But what it produced was never repetitive, never anything you'd expect to see. So it was very exciting.
And no two performances would be the same then.
Well, he didn't change the movement of the dance. He just started the dance choreographed by chance. But once it was set, it was set.
Ah. Can you imagine working that way, Betty Jane? Mr. B wouldn't have done that.
No. I'm to be honest with you, I'm not quite sure I understand exactly what that meant, chance by chance.
He was rolling the dice in that way. Instead of saying, I think it would be nice if you raised your arm, the dice would decide whether you raised your arm or lowered your arm.
I see.
And
like
also, it would put two or three things in sequence that you wouldn't have ordinarily thought of to put in sequence.
He was trying to avoid cliches?
That's right. He was trying to avoid anything that came out of one's imagination. So he had all the parts of the body listed, and then he would throw dice as to which ones would do what. So it was, it did not use his imagination, except the way he put it together.
It disrupts personal choice or your inclination, right?
Right.
So that yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So it goes beyond what you would ordinarily think. And so everything's different. Everything looks new.
I'm wondering how long this lasted for both of you. Betty Jane, after you became a soloist who danced some principal roles, when were you suddenly thought of as one of the older dancers?
Well,
because you're still in your 20s.
I was, yes, but I was getting up there. I mean, there's that joke that Mr. Balanchine would call you an old bag if you had reached 30.
Ooh.
And right, and we, so we were, you know, we were, if you were over 16, you were an old bag, I think. But
whoa.
I'm exaggerating a little bit about that, but... ask me the question again, Leonard.
Well, that was the answer, but I'm also wondering whether, because you were considered one of the older dancers, whether you were expected to take on new responsibilities, like teaching newcomers.
Well, when you start to teach newcomers your roles, it's not a good sign.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in my case, it wasn't... I was reaching the point where I was being encouraged to find something else to do.
And she got married, too.
Yes, I had gotten married, and Mr. Balanchine was not in favor of the dancers getting married and certainly not having babies. And so I think it was a combination of factors that led me to become an old bag.
Oh.
Now, Marianne, you also decided to get married and have a kid.
Yes.
Is that what led you to end your career in dance? At least of your career?
Yeah, because there were other dancers. In fact, the woman who replaced me had two daughters. But I couldn't imagine being a mother and dancing, because dancing took up so much attention and time. So when I decided I wanted to have a baby, it meant that I was going to have to leave the company, which all of us were very sad about. In fact, the last performance I did, when Merce came in to say, he was so sweet all the time about it, and he came in to say goodbye and, you know, say all nice things, and I was bawling my head off, and so was Carolyn Brown. We were in the dressing room, and it was a totally sad occasion, but it was, I mean, he was so sweet about it. It was very nice.
Betty Jane, how long after you left did you start teaching?
I didn't do much of anything in the dance world. When I first left the company, I wanted to have a baby. And so I became pregnant relatively quickly after I had left, and I stayed home for 4 years with my son. And then I got a phone call from Allegra Kent, who offered me a partnership in a school that she had in Scarsdale. And so I did become her partner. And so that's when I started teaching. And then from there, Jacques D'Amboise was dean of dance at Purchase College and called me to come and teach in a summer program, and I've been there ever since.
You're currently a tenured professor there.
I am a tenured professor there.
Do you also, because you put on performances, do you also ever dance with your own company?
No. You mean New York City Ballet?
No,
my own.
With the Purchase.
Oh,
company.
No. I did come out.
There is a picture
You're right. I did come out of retirement after 11 years of not having danced and got myself into shape because we put on a performance of Petrushka, a fundraiser for the college, and I danced the role of the doll. And I was thinner, believe it or not, talking about weight, I was thinner than I had ever been. I had dropped down to 111 pounds, and that was really thin for me.
He would have been impressed.
He would have loved it, and he would have been proud. And I did dance, but that was really the last time I danced.
But you also, you said that one of the reasons you wanted to leave New York City Ballet was you didn't want to go on another tour of the Soviet Union.
That's true. There was a tour planned in the summer of 1972. I had just gotten married, and I found that my allegiance was more to my husband than to Mr. Balanchine at that point. And when you're in the company with Mr. Balanchine, your allegiance is to him.
Mm-hmm. He, Marianne, you said the same with Merce, I imagine.
He wasn't very demanding that way. I wouldn't say it was that was similar, but I do empathize with where your allegiance is. You know, when you get married, it does tend to go to your family.
Were you ever tempted to teach?
Well, I taught I taught while I was dancing. And then afterwards, I moved on to other things.
So what was it like to be in the audience of a performance by your friends and then future generations of Merce students?
Oh, it was just wonderful, especially seeing dances that I had been in, which I had obviously never been able to watch. And that was quite breathtaking and exciting. And, you know, I could feel all the movements myself. And then watching the company develop, becoming more and more astonishingly gifted and beautifully trained, it was very, very exciting. I enjoyed that a lot.
Betty Jane, is it an odd feeling to watch other dancers in roles and which you had performed?
Yes, it is. And there were times shortly after I left the company that I would go to the ballet and I would had this fantasy that I was sitting out front and that they would call me up to dance again and I would have to put my shoes on and get out there. And that was my fantasy. Obviously never happened. But yes, it was difficult because I remembered having worked with Balanchine and remembering what he told us to do.
And then I'm sure some of the dancers were dancing it a little differently than you did. I've been told by dancers, sometimes it's just simply because of the physical makeup of the dancer, the adjustments have to be made. But I'm assuming also over time, things just change a bit.
Things do change over time. And I think Mr. Balanchine knew that was going to happen. But he also changed things for the dancers as well. You know, if they could do something better something that they could do better than someone else, that he would allow them to do that.
Marianne, the same thing happened with you, watching people performing your roles?
Well, they didn't. I mean, it wasn't many years before they were moving on to completely different dances. Mm-hmm. So I only had about a year or two to see things that I had been in. So they didn't change materially. One of the things that was so interesting to me about Mercer's teaching was he never, ever referred to anything emotional. It was just, you know, do this movement to this count and do it as fully as you can. And then what would happen is that some feeling would emerge from the dancer from doing it in exactly the fullest, most positive way they could. And I had this experience with another dancer many years later who was doing a part that I had done. And she asked me for a little assistance. And I watched her, and I said, when I did that, it felt very romantic. And so she then did it with that feeling, and it looked exactly like the way I did it. And then I realized Merce never, ever, ever said, that's romantic. He just said, do your leg swing, bring it up high, do it to the count of four, or whatever it was. You know, and when you did it as fully as you could, a feeling emerged from the body that accompanied it. But he never taught us by way of feelings.
Betty Jane, you've been nodding your head through this whole thing.
I am nodding, Marianne, because it's exactly descriptive of how Balanchine used to work as well. Exactly the same. He would tell us, you know, don't pretend to be a ballerina. Dance it as fully as you can on the right count, and anything that you need to convey is built into the choreography, and it sounds exactly the same as what you're saying.
Ah, that's wonderful.
Mr. B was famous for saying, don't think, just dance, something like that.
And you say Merce said something very similar.
Oh, well, when I interviewed him, he said, I don't impose any feelings on the dancers. I let that come from them. I just tell them what to do.
Betty Jane, in recent years, haven't you also acted as a repetiteur for the Balanchine Trust?
Yes, so, it is. I have, and I do, and I'm. I've staged,
what does that involve?
Well, we have to ask permission from the Balanchine Trust to dance Mr. B's works, but I have been able to do that for the Purchase College Dancers since 1983, and it's an extremely gratifying experience for me and for the students.
Do you ever incorporate some of your own ideas into the choreography, or you try to remain totally true to Balanchine?
I try to remain totally true, but just to go back to what Marianne was saying, if the and I tell my students that they don't have to try and be something that they're not, all they have to do is dance fully, full out, on the count, to the music, and that's all they need to do, and it all works.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she's staged for professional companies, too, stage Balanchine works, not just for Purchase, but for professional companies.
Right.
What do you tell... What advice do you give to aspiring dancers? Marianne, didn't your granddaughter, Lizzie
yes.
Feuerstein, take Cunningham classes?
Yes, she did, and she even performed in one of his studio concerts, which was wonderful to watch, just wonderful.
But do you have advice that you would give to a dancer, or is this something that each person, each dancer has to work out for herself?
Well, I would advise them to eat well, sleep well, and don't do anything to hurt yourself. If you do get hurt, heal it up as fast as you can.
Again, you're nodding your head, Betty.
I am, because that's really a great answer. And I was sitting here worried that you were going to ask me the same question, Leonard, and that I wouldn't know what to say. And but, Marianne, you're absolutely right. Take care of yourself.
Yes.
Don't starve yourself to death.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Do you both agree with Alistair McCauley that many dancers find that they understand better in retrospect what they've been part of?
Is that my question?
For either of you. But, yeah, why don't you start, Betty Jane? I mean, when you were working on this book, did you start to understand things that you might not have understood otherwise because you were seeing them in retrospect?
I think I understood, and I don't know if this is answering your question, but I think I began to understand more about myself and about my motivation for my behavior over the years. And so I'd say that was a real process for me. It became a revelatory experience writing my experiences, because I kept remembering things. As Elizabeth would ask me questions, I kept remembering things and why I did them. And yes.
And you also talked about how you didn't necessarily know it when you were in the company, but after looking back, that it was really a golden era for Balanchine. He choreographed some of his most important works while you were there. Yeah,
that's true.
And do you see that reflected in ballet today? Do we still see Balanchine in contemporary ballet? I'm sure you're still going to performances. Well,
yes.
You're also teaching.
Yes, and contemporary ballet has its place, but I'm not a big fan of contemporary ballet. I prefer to see that point of view that Balanchine had, and I'm kind of going off on a tangent here.
What about you, Marianne? How do you think that Mercer's dance style compares with today's modern dance choreographers?
Well, I think that what he did was break enough bonds that attached people to certain styles, so that people are doing all kinds of novel movement now and new kinds of dances. I don't know that they're influenced by his dancing, but they're influenced by his effectively breaking certain connections that had been going on for a long time. And so I think he's released choreographers to go in 100 directions, which is excellent. I probably wouldn't enjoy almost any of them, because I was so absorbed by Cunningham's style and what he produced that I found everybody else to be extremely boring. So I don't admire that particularly, but that is what happened.
The University Press of Florida has just released two memoirs by my guests today. Dancing with Mercer Cunningham is by Marianne Prager-Simon, and Broadway Balanchine and Beyond is written by Betty Jane Sills with Elizabeth McPherson. It's been a great pleasure talking to such wonderful people. Thank you so much for being on the show.
So thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you very much.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks again to Marianne Prager-Simon, Betty Jane Sills, and Elizabeth McPherson, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent, who is at the audio controls. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.